You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or listen via Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast app. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
Hello, everyone. Thank you so much for coming. We're delighted to be here at Brookings. I'm Alexia Diarco, President of Young Professionals in Foreign Policy, and we are absolutely thrilled to have on stage Josh Mark Hughes and John Allen with us tonight. We're thankful to Brookings not only for finding time in the General's very busy schedule, but also for hosting us this evening for what I know will be a very compelling discussion followed by a lovely reception. For those who don't know us, YPFP is an independent international affairs organization that builds the leaders the world needs. We've been around for 14 years, and in that time, we've amassed a global community of 20,000 professionals in over 80 countries, dynamic, diverse individuals from all sectors. Tonight's event is the last in what we call our Burst Your Bubble series, which featured service events, innovative panel discussions, dinner and dialogues, and fireside chats with inspirational leaders, the like of which we have here with us tonight. This series encouraged our members, our partners, and supporters to think unconventionally and to engage with peers from across a wide array of backgrounds, experiences, and ideological perspectives. The campaign will culminate on November 10 at Sydney Harmon Hall here in D.C. with YPFP's annual Black Tie Gala, at which we will honor two rising leaders, one civilian and one veteran, who demonstrate the kind of leadership demanded by the challenges of the 21st century: innovative, agile, collaborative, and ethical. Leadership is, of course, one of the many themes we'll be talking about tonight, and I can't think of a more dynamic duo than John Allen and Josh Mark Hughes to guide us through this discussion, to take us both deep and wide on challenges and the U.S. role in addressing these challenges, whether we're talking about North Korea or artificial intelligence, and what the U.S. in particular can do to guide us globally as we address those challenges. As I mentioned, we're here at Brookings, where General Allen needs no introduction, but for those who are not fortunate enough to have come across him yet, I just wanted to flag that he has spent over four decades, we won't talk about age, but four decades worth of experience, still young at heart, including in that time period serving as commander of the International Security Assistance Force in Afghanistan. He's currently approaching the anniversary of his first year at Brookings, serving as the eighth president of this wonderful institution in over 100 years of its history. Our moderator, Josh Mark Hughes, is a YPFP's founder and board chairman, and in his day job sits across the river at the Pentagon, where he's the executive director of the Defense Innovation Board. Josh, John, over to the two of you.
Thank you so much.
Thanks very much.
Well, first of all, let me echo Alexia's thanks. We're thrilled to be here. We've gotten to enjoy a number of extraordinary conversations with Brookings junior staff and senior fellows and presidents over the last 14 years, and this is a great installment in that proud tradition.
Great.
We'll talk about a lot of different foreign policy issues. We'll talk about some inside Washington issues, but I figured, given your long history of public service, let's start with some national security question.
Okay.
So we are fond of talking about what we call sort of the top five threats that have been prominently featured in U.S. national security strategy as cricket: China, Russia, Iran, Korea, and terrorism. So I was hoping you might say a word or two about each of those and give us a sense of your assessment of our current posture and where you think we'll be with that country or that issue over the next decade.
Well, first, Alexia, thank you for letting us host you here tonight, Josh, and the group. And let me just make the offer that if you want to consider Brookings your home, you'd be most welcome here. So this is a really important organization. We have got to prepare the next generation to take the torch from this generation, who's largely been pouring water on the torch for the last several years. But we're really honored to have you here, and Brookings, I hope, can be a home for you when you need it for any events that you'd like to run. So please don't hesitate to reach out to us. We talk about the 4+1 or cricket. I'll try to simplify what I would normally say, which I could spend a lot of time on each one of them. From my perspective, the R, Russia. Russia is a hostile force, as far as I'm concerned. It's a power that is a revanchist power that has sought in recent years both to secure through its own internal governmental dynamics, secure its own capacity to govern over a long period of time through Putin, but more importantly, the actions to sever the Crimea, to create a separatist movement in the Donbas, to threaten the eastern flank of NATO very tangibly, to interfere in the democracies of Europe, I think without question. I just came back from Paris, literally just recently came back from Paris, where we had long conversations about how close a call we came with the election in Paris. And then, of course, the Russian intrusion into the U.S. system of democracy, our voting process, they were deep, deep inside our electoral processes, and they apparently still are. So the context of the Gerasimov Doctrine, military change of the borders of Europe, the separatist movements in the Ukraine, all of those things together lead me to conclude that Russia is a hostile power to the United States, and we need to treat them that way. Doesn't mean we need to go to war with them, doesn't mean we shouldn't talk to them, but we need to be very, very careful about our relationship with Russia going forward. I feel differently about China, although I think we have, in many respects, we find ourselves in a different place with China than we did just a year ago. When I talk to the Chinese, and I do talk with them relatively frequently, I talk about what I call the four C's with respect to the U.S. relationship with China. The first C is to seek opportunity to cooperate where we can with the Chinese, and I think there are many ways that we can cooperate with the Chinese. And while some might call the Chinese an enemy state, I don't view them that way. I have a long relationship with the Chinese in many different places in the world, and I view them as a state with whom we can, in the second C, find ourselves competing. And I think we do find ourselves competing on a regular basis, but competition isn't necessarily bad, and we ought to be looking for opportunity in the context of competition. But I worry about the third C, which is as we continue in, a downward spiral of bombast and negative rhetoric, and in this what we thought was going to be an easy-to-win trade war, we're finding ourselves increasingly with the Chinese in a environment of confrontation. I've been in those environments before, out on the edge of American influence or in world affairs, where you are on the edge of a tinderbox, and it will not take much in the Taiwan Straits or in the South China Sea or somewhere with respect to North Korea. It will not take much for us to move very quickly from confrontation to the fourth of the four C's, which is conflict. And we are two great nations. We both need to recognize that there is far more that can be accomplished between the United States and China when we cooperate or when we leverage opportunity out of competition than if we find ourselves in conflict. And we need to be very careful in managing that relationship. Right now, I have very strong concerns about where we are with the China relationship. And in much of that, I can understand the trade issues associated with why we wanted to change certain dimensions of our trade and economic relationship. And I think the Chinese have made efforts to try to change that. We're never going to change it for in every possible way we want to. But the bombast, the unnecessary negative rhetoric, which is, in fact, causing the deterioration of the relationship, we have to be very, very careful here. Because we have the Belt and Road Initiative, which may or may not be good, but I have my own views on it. We're going to need the Chinese help with respect to North Korea. And if you don't know anything about the Taiwan relationship, that's a go-to-war issue for the Chinese in the event that the Taiwans ultimately determined that they are in a place where they could declare independence. The Chinese will not hesitate to use military force in that regard. And then the South China Sea is a jump ball from my perspective. They didn't need to fortify it. They've done it anyway, and I think we're going to have some problems there. We don't have a comprehensive China policy, and in the absence of that comprehensive China policy, one-off events tend ultimately to negatively trend the whole relationship. Iran... I think Iran was one of the Iran is, without question, from my perspective, having spent much of the last 25 years in the Middle East, is the principal source of destabilization in the region. And apart from the current problems we have with the Saudis and the kingdom and the assassination of Khashoggi, the Iranians have sought ultimately to both drive a wedge between the United States and our other Arab partners in the region, but has also taken advantage of the outcome of the Arab Spring to take advantage, obviously, of instability in Lebanon, instability in Syria, instability in Iraq, instability in Yemen, instability in Bahrain, and they've taken advantage of that. At the same time they've done all of that, they have very clearly pursued a nuclear weapons program. And the result of that, of course, was the JCPOA, which even though it was flawed, it curtailed the capacity of the Iranians to have a complete nuclear fuel cycle for a period of 10 years. It would ultimately become a UN Security Council resolution, which made it a matter of international law. Now we've walked away from it. We should be very careful, as the United States, walking away from any agreement where the United States, China, and Russia, the other members of the P5, the EU, and Germany, and Iran, any agreement where all of us sign that piece of paper and we walk away from it expecting we're going to get a better deal to have the Iranians shovel all the rest of their regional behavior into that agreement. It's irresponsible, frankly. And so I think we're in an issue. We're at a point now where the next shoe could drop and we could find even more instability in the region. North Korea is North Korea. We need to be careful not to delude ourselves that denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula, as we understand it, will be the same kind of denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula as Kim Jong-un understands it. I was part of the six-party talks years ago, where I think we had the capacity ultimately to get farther in that process, bringing all the relevant parties in, and of course all the same relevant parties are involved now. But we need to not confuse ourselves that photo ops double for serious diplomacy. And I know a lot of people in the government are working very hard at the State Department. I have such strong feelings for the State Department and our diplomats and our Foreign Service officers. We need to not delude ourselves into believing that where we are right now is going to get us to a completely denuclearized North Korea. What that means is we need to have a close relationship with the Japanese, close relationship with the South Koreans. We need to leverage our relationship such as it is with the Chinese. We need to ensure that the Russians are not vetoing the work that we're doing and make it very clear to the North Koreans that there are benefits that can come from a complete denuclearization, but there's also very severe sanctions that can come if you seek to gun deck us on this thing. That's a Navy term, by the way. And then finally, I guess the other continent is terrorism. You know, I want to be very careful that we don't create, as we have, it seemed, through the 2015-2016 campaign, this sense that this is about Islam, that terrorism, if terrorism equals Islam, and it doesn't, it's important that we are able to make the distinction that much of the jihadi activity we see in the world today comes out of a doctrine of Salafi jihadism. And if you understand what the Salafist doctrine is, it harkens back to that period of time in the early days, immediately in the aftermath of the Prophet Muhammad, where the idealized Muslim community at the time, the community of believers, was known as the Salaf. And so in the minds of elements within the faith of Islam and the confession, the Sunnah confession, returning to the time of the Salaf is the greatest moment of purity of the Muslim community. And it occurred during the first four caliphs, the righteous companions of Muhammad, known as the Rashidun. So the Salafi jihadis are the elements within the Sunni confession of Islam who seek to reestablish the community of purity in the world today. What they choose not to embrace is that Muhammad called for the proselytizing of Islam in two ways. One was, and it's the most important way, and the vast majority of Muslims, I think, adhere to this, is emulation. Live your life in a pious way so that those around you who watch you in your day-to-day interactions would want to emulate this high moral standard of your faith. But there's another way, and that is through coercion, through the logical, violent extreme of something called the jihad, which is really about the struggle. So the Salafi jihadists, not interested in emulation, seek to carry through the fire and the sword the conversion of segments of the population. So that's more than you wanted on those 4 plus 1, but I'm telling you, every single one of those in the environment that we're in Washington today, where we have difficulties with the formulation of coherent policy, creates for us an ongoing challenge that we're going to have to watch very closely. Sorry to go on so long.
No, that was fascinating. Let me turn to a different way of addressing those important, talking about alliances. So the National Defense Strategy elevates alliances and partnerships to one of the top three priorities for the whole department. Mm-hmm. But I think I can diplomatically say that the White House seems to favor a more unilateral approach and is somewhat more skeptical of international organizations like, for example, NATO. Mm-hmm. How do you assess U.S. leadership in the world today?
Yeah, well, a couple of things. The United States has, and certainly in the aftermath of World War II and the Cold War, been at its very best when we were engaged in multilateral organizations and multilateral relationships. And at the outer edge of that, from my perspective, has been the great work of American diplomacy and foreign policy wielded by and large through our ambassadors and our foreign service officers. That's the convincing edge of American leadership from my perspective. And we are at our very best when we are part of organizations and subsets of the community of nations. And so you can approach this one of two ways. You can approach it as we seem to be approaching it today, which is transactional in a bilateral relationship. And America first, in many respects, means America isolated. Or you can approach it from the confidence and the sense that America as part of a multilateral organization or a ad hoc coalition has a transformational role in that process. I really believe it's the latter, not the former. And transformational means that all of us together, the sum total of the community of nations engaged in that organization or in that task or toil, all of us are better because we transform each other by growing and taking strength from each other. But when it's transactional, someone's on top and someone's number two. When it's bilateral, then we lose the potential synergy that comes when similarly minded nations gather together either to deal with some of the greatest daunting planet issues on the planet or to elevate humankind. So relationships are utterly important to the United States. And when I talk to our friends overseas, I tell them that, you know, sometimes when you get frustrated with what appears to be U.S. leadership, please remember that there is a strata of leaders in the United States who are American leaders who, in fact, remain committed to multilateralism, who remain committed to the transformational role of the United States in the world today. And don't despair. And don't make any formal, long-term, structural decisions in your relationships, because there will come the day when someone is in the White House who absolutely does, in fact, recognize the transformational role the United States plays in the world today in multilateral organizations and in the community of nations.
At risk of going a little bit off topic, I just want to reflect. It's fascinating to me that that is the message that you share, because it actually shows another important role that civil society institutions like Brookings plays in sort of balancing out the totality of the sort of American polity. It's very interesting that that's a sort of a natural organic check and balance on some of the, I would say, sort of stochastic swings perhaps in our policy that may give whiplash to our members. That's fascinating. Well, let me turn from current events to future trends. We have an interesting way of trying to pulse you on future trends, sir, if you'll heed us. We actually did an informal poll of our members to try to figure what they thought the salient future trends were over the next 20 years of global affairs, which I know is sort of probably the era of their careers where they're going to watch this puzzle unfold, either fall apart or come together. And so here's what they said. This was their top five, and then I'm going to ask you to react to it.
Sure.
Economic globalization, climate change and environmental degradation, demographic changes, especially aging, mass migration, particularly urbanization and littoralization, the moving of people to the coasts, and last, accelerating technological change. So what would you add or drop for your top five list?
Well, let me just tell you, I've spent a good bit of time over the last several years dealing with something I call the megatrends. And in many respects, what the members here identified are the ones that most concern me. I do worry, and I perhaps come from a generation and an era where we worried a lot about this first, and then other things later. I do worry about nuclear proliferation. You know, we just walked away from the Iran deal. Some of you in here probably might have been working with me on the issue. I was one of the folks that authored the war plan to deal with this if we needed to. It's a very real issue. North Korea has an ICBM and probably a miniaturized warhead that can be delivered, if not on the United States, certainly close. The Iranians, you know, we didn't know that they had the capability of spinning a lot of centrifuges for a long time. You bury it deep enough and it's difficult to find. There are other states out there who are going to watch the way North Korea unfolds and are going to watch the way we deal with Iran and recognize that if you're able ultimately to achieve a nuclear capability, there is a certain amount of security and a certain amount of impunity that will come from that. And so for me, again, from the generation when as a small child I huddled under my desk in drills for nuclear attacks, I'm very sensitive to us never taking our eye off the ball that nuclear non-proliferation is an essential dimension of our policy, and nuclear proliferation is something that we have to keep our eye on and worry about all the time. I think, you know, there's lots of things that worry me from moment to moment, but I believe that we have the capacity as a nation and as a people to deal with China and Russia and eventually handle the Iranians and deal with the Koreans. But there are some things coming at us which I think really do worry me, and it reinforces, I think, the views of the members. You know, climate change is, I think, one of the great challenges we're going to have in the 21st century. And you used the term coastalization. I'm not so sure that climate change doesn't work an exact opposite or exact as a countervailing force with respect to climate or coastalization. You know, we're going to face a time, I believe, with rising sea levels, the change in weather patterns as a result of the warming of the sea surfaces, that the enraged weather patterns and higher sea levels are going to drive large segments of populations away from the coast because they no longer simply can afford to live on the coastline. So I worry about climate change. I worry about rapid desertification. And that then will drive what we call climate migration. And I think climate migration is something we have to account for. We see conflict migration, we see economic migration, but I don't believe we've really, as a community of interested parties and as the community of nations, paid enough attention to what climate migration is going to look like. And if you don't like the other two, you're going to hate climate migration when it finally starts to hit around the middle of the century. Rapid urbanization is another outcome, I think, of what we will see as a result of climate change. And as we know, in many cases, in the developing world, mega cities, which are 10 million or more, we're going to see a huge influx of population into these cities. By the middle of the century, almost 75% of the global population will be in mega cities or urban centers. Many of these are going to be in the developing world, where there is, frankly, very limited capacity of the central governments or the municipal governments to provide the kinds of services and law enforcement and education and infrastructure necessary for these populations. So what we will see, and you know this well from the world you live in, Josh, we will see more and more talk about something called the mega slums, which are millions of people that blister onto urban centers because they have no future on the ground because of desertification and other aspects of climate change or conflict. And now you have Mumbai-like slums, where sometimes people use the term ungoverned space. But that's not, I don't like the term. I prefer that we not use it, because government is going on in there, but you can't stand it. It's non-state actors, and it's transnational criminal networks with connectivity and networking and resources which rival many sovereign states. We've got to pay attention to this, the rapid urbanization. And then, of course, again, I would concur on demography. Yes, we're going to age. By 2050, 20% of the world's population will be 60 years of age or older. Now, when I was your age, 60 years of age was one foot in the grave. From my, now that I'm going to be drawing Social Security at the end of this year, I happen to think it's a very robust age with lots of potential future ahead of them. But as the population ages, the workforce shrinks. So we're going to have to think about productivity. This is where robotics and artificial intelligence will come in. But as the workforce ages, or as the population ages, now we have insurance issues, we have health care issues. Mm-hmm. But if you flip that same coin over, in much of the developing world, we're seeing the population expand at a very rapid rate and becoming much younger in areas where the central governments have very limited capacity to provide for the aspirations of these young men and women. What that does is it creates frustration, it creates migration, it creates radicalization, which then can be pushed into the arms of extremists, and then you have the proliferation of terrorism. So, look, we got to deal with what's in front of us, and that's cricket. But for you all, the leaders of the next of this generation and the next generation, it are these global megatrends that are immutable, that we've got to begin to think about at a strategic level. And so we walked away from the Paris Climate Accord. You know, we've got to be thinking about what that means. Thank God that there are large numbers of American leaders in the United States who have chosen in their roles as either governors or mayors to continue to embrace the Paris climate standards. But we've got to deal with this. And if we don't deal with this, the emergency that we will face towards the end of the 21st century will be very difficult, frankly.
Of those five issues, obviously we looked at the significant threats each one of them poses. Is there one of those trends that you think is an opportunity that this generation can seize?
Well, technology, I think, is incredibly opportune for us right now. I've got my phone somewhere, but there's more computing power on that phone than was than we had at our fingertips to put a human on the moon. And it's only 10 years old. Think of, well, many of you may not be able to remember it beyond that, but think about what this has done for us in terms of the networking capacity of humankind to be in touch with us, with each other. Plus the advent of supercomputing, soon eventually to become quantum computing. What that does with things like natural language processing or deep natural language processing, machine learning, the overall rubric of artificial intelligence, I think there are opportunities for the improvement of the quality of life and the length of time that we live as healthy human beings that we can now not imagine. Technologies of modern cities, technologies in healthcare, technologies associated with education. Education is going to shift very, very dramatically from how you teach to how you learn. It's profoundly different. Teachers will be profoundly different in the role that they'll have in the classroom. And virtual reality in conjunction with artificial intelligence in the context of teaching is just going to change everything. So I think that the advent of technology, while there are dark sides to that, and we're going to have to watch it in the world you live in, I know you've got an eye on that every single day, I think the potential value of well-regulated, well-intentioned technology in a public-private partnership with the private sector working very carefully with the public sector, ultimately to ensure that technology has creates corporate social responsibility. I think it's really a boundless moment for us, and I'm quite optimistic about that.
So AI optimist. I wish I could have asked you just 25 questions about only AI, but we're going to move on. But I would say to everyone, do do a quick search and look up some of the things that John's written about AI, particularly his notion of hyperwar. He's really one of the most thoughtful commentators about AI and its impact on public policy. I know that's something you're dedicating a lot of effort to at Brookings right now.
That's right, at Brookings. Yeah.
But so let's talk a bit more about Brookings then for a couple questions. So in this era of fake news, hyper-partisanship, social media, shortening attention spans, and growing populism, how do you run the world's highest rated think tank?
Let's see. Is Jen in here somewhere? Jen and Emily. Emily's my new vice president for communications. The way we do this is to, first of all, recognize the strategic environment in which we operate today. And you've just gone a long way towards describing it. Short attention spans, electoral cycles, alternative sources of information, alternative facts, what Rand calls truth decay, the environment we live in, often called the post-truth environment. Look, think tanks have got to be agile. In other words, they've got to be able to shift quickly onto an emerging issue, and they've got to be flexible within their organization so that you can both harvest the quality of scholarship possible and concentrate that scholarship on a particular issue as you shift the institution onto a key issue. You've got to be able to move quickly, number one. Number two, Rudy Giuliani said once, truth is not truth. Okay, well, that confused everyone, but let me just make a point. Truth is a matter of accuracy. And when a think tank produces a product, it is the very best objective, evidence-based scholarship that we can bring to bear. And from my perspective, what I believe, I really believe this, and there are probably folks in here from other think tanks, and you know, thank you for the work you're doing every single day. I think that the Brookings product, in terms of the quality of the scholarship and the accuracy of its output, is as close to truth as we can define it at any particular moment. Now, what I mean by that is we're going to work hard inside Brookings to bring to the campus the capacity to bring both big data and predictive data analytics as a matter of natural routine for the scholars. Now, we have many scholars to do it as a matter of course. And where Emily plays an important part is the capacity to bring big data analytics happens to sharpen your capacity to make conclusions because it's supported not just by objective and subjective scholarship, but now you have a capacity for big data analytics that gives you the statistics with very high levels of precision that can support ultimately the product as well. Once again, it's a matter of the accurate product. It may not be full truth because we're still discovering information, but it is as close to accuracy as you can get, and I want to bring that kind of tool set to our scholars so that the work that we do, the public policy that we produce, the recommendations we make for the president and for the Congress and for those who need to make policy decisions, when they look at a product coming out of this institution, I want them to have high levels of confidence. It's the best possible, it's the most accurate and the best possible swag that we have towards truth. That's really important from my perspective. So you've got to be organized inside to be able to shift quickly. Your funding sources have got to be readily maneuverable so that you can shift funding quickly within the organization so you can bring the scholars together on a particular issue, fund it quickly, and they move out sharply to begin the research and the scholarship. But it's a critical moment for think tanks. And from the moment that I took over Brookings, I said, I want the institution to help the president to govern and the Congress to legislate. You know, if we can help the president be successful with the work of the scholarship that we're doing and the policy recommendations we make, then we're all successful. If we can help the Congress to legislate, to pass laws in support of the American people, then we're all successful. So from my perspective, we're not lining up against anybody. What we want to do is produce, again, nonpartisan, fact-based, research-oriented public policy recommendations that can help the president or other leaders to govern, and this Congress and other legislatures to pass laws. And if we're successful in doing that, then we're doing our duty. If we're not pulling out all stops to try to make that happen, then we're sub-optimized.
Brookings is a venerable institution, but when I think of establishment, it might be the first thing that comes to mind. What advice do you have for younger people, like those in our club, mm-hmm. who want to help your industry by disrupting it?
Disrupting it. Well, I think we're pretty impervious to disruption, actually. Look, I've been president for a year, although it feels like it was most of the last 100. I think many of the folks in this room see the world differently than I saw the world when I was coming up. And I happen to think that it's frankly, far more complex. In this institution, one of my hiring objectives, beyond an absolute commitment to doing all we can for diversity here, because I truly believe that we are a nation that thrives because of diversity, and we fail because of divisiveness. I want to hire younger scholars. I need the youth, first of all, who are willing to stay here for a few years, but I want the youth that younger scholars bring to the table at this institution to give us the perspective, the unique and youthful perspective from the environment in which we live today that can help to make the products even better. So, you know, I hate that term, you know. So the unique experiences you've had in your education, the unique experiences that you're having in your day-to-day duties, whatever those might be, that's a very different youthful experience than mine was, given the time that I was growing up. And I think that bringing that into the process of the formulation of public policy is absolutely vital. And it goes back to what I said about passing the torch. You know, we did the best we can in the Cold War. We've done the best we could in the aftermath of the Cold War. We've got to hand you the capacity to make the contribution to public policy by virtue of the unique perspectives that you've had based on your youthful experiences, both in terms of networking with each other and the education experience you've had, and growing up now as young professionals in an environment which I think is far more complex than it was when I was your age.
So you mentioned diversity, and I actually wanted to highlight this because this is something that you all may have missed. You actually, when you got the internal report from your staff at Brookings about the diversity numbers, you actually chose to publish it on the website, which I think was a courageous act of public self-reflection, highlighting for you, but as well as your board and your donors and your own employees, that you wanted Brookings to do better. And I thought that was an incredible example of transparency. Why did you make that decision, which could not have been easy? And what advice would you offer for other organizations? And I'll follow your example. I would say Young Professionals in Foreign Policy fits that description of an organization that needs to do better on diversity. What would you recommend for others that want to show that kind of leadership and commitment?
Well, I think the last few days have been pretty awful for us as a people. The proliferation of hate speech, the wedges that have been driven into the society of America along race and gender and preference, ethnicity, faith, all of those things fragment the unity and the synergy that comes from all of us being together in a diverse world. Look, my context is having been an infantryman in the Marine Corps and at the latter part of my career in two wars as a uniformed officer and then a third war as a diplomat. And I have seen my Marines and soldiers go forward under fire. Every race, every ethnicity, every preference, every faith, and not one of them gave a damn about any of that with respect to the others. And they were willing to shed their lives instantly for the other. And if that is the strength of diversity, which I think it is, then I believe that we have an obligation, an institute like this, which is supposed to set a public policy example, We have an obligation to do the same. We're not anywhere near where we need to be. From my perspective, diversity isn't an end state. It's a process. You first commit yourself. You first, as an organization, commit yourself to being diverse. And that's not rocket science. It is an acknowledgement that we as a nation are better together in all of our many different forms and fashion than we are apart. So you commit yourself to diversity, and if you're serious about it, you're willing to talk about it publicly. And, you know, I'll take some hits over time because those needles aren't going to change very fast. But by God, we're going to work at changing them all. Part of it's going to be the age. Part of it's going to be the diversity. Part of it is going to be the things that we do. I mean, there's diversity in many different ways. But I think an institution that's serious about being diverse ought to be willing to put their numbers out there and then try to move the needles.
If I could just take a moment to hark back to one of the things you said at the beginning about Islam and the importance of emulation, of a moral example, I would say that what little power Alexia and I have with the stage that we have at our disposal, we use to shine a light on leaders who share the kind of character that we think our members should look up to.
Good for you.
What you just said on the stage was very moving, and I think we did a good job in asking you to share your views with this group. So thank you
for
that.
Honored to be with you. No, thank you.
Well, let me close with a couple questions about that topic of leadership, because that is first and foremost what this organization is about, even more so than international affairs. It's about developing leaders. So I wanted to ask you two questions. The first one is, what was the best piece of leadership advice you received as a young officer?
That in everything you should strive to be a humble servant of those you lead. It's never about power. It's never about lauding a position of authority over another. You should be a humble servant, meaning humility. It's never about you, ever about you. It's always about everyone else. It's always about the mission. You have to square the two. It's mission first and people always, and sometimes in executing the mission, you pay a price for it. But the leader... And this doesn't matter. Doesn't mean a uniformed leader. It just means a leader. A leader who is both a humble individual and is oriented on servitude, serving the people and the organization. Those are the finest qualities. And there's many qualities that I would talk about if you wanted to. But one of my commanders said to me, if you're a humble servant and someone accuses you of that, then you should render yourself guilty as charged. And I, you know, my own experience was the opposite often of humility is an arrogant leader. And I got no time for arrogant leaders because arrogance, and I'm not being jingoistic here, but arrogance is just a very small distance away from ignorance. And ignorant, arrogant leaders do more to deprive an organization of its potential, full potential, than almost anything else. And in the world I came from, ignorant, arrogant leaders got people killed. And so I frankly got rid of them as often as I could. But I have an obligation to develop the people who work with me. I don't say work for me, they work with me. So a humble servant is the very finest. And that commander helped me early in my career to try to live that way, if I could.
I hope you sent your HR director to the reception after this, because I think everyone wants to send a resume to Brookings right now. Listen, I really think that we've hit the high points in this interview, and let's turn to audience questions, shall we? So please ask a one-part genuine question. So as many as you can, please state your name and where you work, and we've got microphones circulating. So we'll start with the gentleman in the back, who's the fastest on the draw with his hand there, and we'll turn this gentleman in the front next. Please, go ahead.
Thank you. My name is Lewis Wilkins. I work for my own business, selling expertise in economics, finance, data science, tutoring by Lewis.
Good.
My question is about think tanks. We may be a little bit biased. I think it's fantastic for think tanks to be nonpartisan. What role do you think there is in the public discourse for think tanks that have an ideological perspective, are funded to advance an ideological perspective, you know, assuming the conclusion rather than purely looking at the facts?
Sure.
Are they useful? Do they have any role?
Yeah, I wouldn't call them a think tank if that's the way they operated, frankly. We have three principles that we operate on here. One is independence, the other is quality, and the third is impact. All of them are really important to us. We hope it's sort of in our DNA, but of those, if I had to choose one, the starting point is independence. So the institution is this institution, and I won't speak for any others because I'm not part of any others. This institution seeks in every possible way to be as independent as we possibly can be on a subject. So when we begin the process, we have a thesis or a hypothesis that we're seeking ultimately to research, but we don't start with a conclusion and reverse engineer it for anybody. And as you may know, we have to raise some money from time to time, but a very key point of that, and it's in every document that we would ever hand to someone who would be interested in supporting our research, is the absolute requirement that two things happen. The first is that our work is independent, and the second is that we will publish the work. So nobody's going to have a secret relationship with us, and we're producing product or producing outcomes that will not be exposed to the light of day. So there are entities out there that call themselves think tanks that may operate differently than ours, but from my perspective, independence is the first and probably the most important dimension of a real think tank.
Great. And you're next, sir. And then a woman in white and green next after that.
Yes, General. My name is Cammy Bhatt. I'm with the Pakistani Spectator.
Yes.
And my question is about declaring victory in Afghanistan. Given you don't seem to have any contempt for Islam, you know, contrary to prevalent notion that Islam is a religion of terrorism, it's very easy for you to negotiate with Taliban because first thing they demand or wish is respect. They are very poor, but they want respect from other people because that's how Pathan or Khan people are. And number two, I think I forget the name of the Pakistani general who did very successful operation in that part of the world. Now he works for Saudi government. And number three, you call China and U.S. a great friendship, nations.
First two
Do you think we should trust Pakistani government and Chinese government to participate more in that part of the world so it could help us to return from Afghanistan? Because you would be doing a great favor to Trump, who just want to pack our bags from that part of the world. Thanks.
I'm not sure I followed all of that. Because you had a lot to say. And
basically, backing our back from Afghanistan.
Well, I think the United States ought to be seeking to bring as many of the stakeholders in peace in that region to the table as we possibly can. Obviously, I spend a lot of time in Rawalpindi and Islamabad speaking with Pakistani leaders, and I've got great affection for them. And there's no secret that we have a lot of tension between our government and Pakistan. But we also recognize that there was a time when Pakistan and the United States lined up with each other against the Soviets. And so it depends on where history begins. And for me, I remember when the Pakistani force in Mogadishu went out the day we lost a couple of Black Hawks, and at a great cost to the Pakistani forces, rescued the American raider force that came in. So lots of us don't forget that Pakistan every day loses people in the federally administered tribal areas, fighting against the insurgencies there and other places. So we need to, I think, be objective in our view with respect to Pakistan. But we still have tensions. I also recognize that there's a close relationship between China and Pakistan. You've described yourself as Pakistani, so I'll say you. Pakistan describes China as its all-weather friend and America as its fair-weather friend. Okay, well, look, we can vary on that. But I think China, who I believed had an important role to play in Afghanistan, has also an important role to play in Pakistan. So why wouldn't we seek to have a relationship, the United States with China, that can both stabilize a democracy in Pakistan and also create relationships in Afghanistan that could perhaps create a peace opportunity for peaceful conversations, economic opportunity, and continue. Just as I would say there's a role for India in this process also. So when the United States is at its best, it seeks to bring, the United States brings two things to all challenges in the world. Convening power, strategic leadership, and global reach. We should be using our convening power and our global reach to bring as many stakeholders into the future of Afghanistan as we possibly can, recognizing that a stable, sovereign, prosperous Afghanistan in Pakistan's rear creates stability for Pakistan as well. And I think that's an important outcome. And I don't view anything that occurs in Afghanistan in isolation from how it might be helpful to Pakistan, how it might be helpful to the region. And I think we need to think strategically like that and not myopically focusing solely on the Taliban in Afghanistan. I think it's a broader conversation than that.
Ma'am, you are next with a very pithy one-part question, and then is there, and you, ma'am, in the front will be next. Thank you very much.
Hello, my name is Sarah.
Does pithy mean short?
Yes. It does.
Okay, thank you.
Brief, succinct. We'll use all of the adjectives for short.
Concise. My name is Sarah Valkenberg. I'm from McLarty Associates. I was hoping you could elaborate perhaps upon the non-traditional spaces that the United States could fill in regards to foreign policy formation, especially as we see the U.S. pulling back from those traditional forums such as intergovernmental organizations.
Sure. Well, you know, again, the United States is a nation that I think is a group that has the capacity to contribute in many non-traditional ways. There have been other administrations that made a huge difference in AIDS research and in the solution to AIDS in the developing world. There are many states that are in very serious trouble with respect to economic progress. Here, the United States, through USAID and non-governmental organizations, and the use of sophisticated computing and artificial intelligence, can make a huge contribution to many of these states in the context of agriculture, education, standing for the rights of women in the world. These are areas where the United States, I think, has very important roles to play that are not in the context of traditional diplomacy, that are functionally oriented, that contribute to segments of the population regardless of how borders have cut them into smaller pieces. So I think that the United States has both a leadership responsibility and unique capacities to contribute. And I didn't touch this, but you know, I spent a lot of time as a commander in Afghanistan supporting women in civil society. And I can remember the conversations that I had with Hamid Karzai about how he can never hope to take Afghanistan from being a post-conflict society to a developing society or even a developed society unless he brought, as we say, the people that hold up half the sky, unless women were brought into the mainstream. And it's the same that it needs to be, it has to be, a central thesis in American foreign policy and foreign relations, that we stand for the rights of minorities, we stand for the rights of women, and that's a unique contribution that we can make that almost nobody else can make, because we could put the resources behind that national objective. Now, are we doing it right now? Look, again, I could sit up here and wring my hands and gnash my teeth on the particular issues that we seem to have walked away from. But I also have great confidence in the American people that we are a people that stand for the rule of law and human rights and to help those who are less fortunate than ourselves. I believe that that's who we are. That's the idea of America. And we might have a difficulty right now, but I think that's a short-term problem. But we've got some domestic issues we've got to deal with right now as well if we're ever going to be able to project the kind of influence that America has the potential to project. I'm not sure I got even to your question. But these are really important things from my perspective. America has to stand for something. We got to stand for something. And if we don't stand for something, who else will? And the smaller countries in the coalition that I led in Afghanistan, 50 countries, and then 65 countries against Daesh, the Islamic State, you know, their concern was, if the United States pulls back, who will be for us? And if you look at the young democracies in Central Europe today, constantly under attack by the Russians in some form or another, who will stand for us? No one else on the planet can. And there will be countries who will try to be helpful within the context of the size of their populations and their economies, etc. But no one can organize the community of nations the way we can to deal with the most daunting problems that we face today, whether it's climate change or the rights of women or leveraging all of the advantages that increases in technology will bring us someday. Nobody but us. And if we don't stand for that, then what are we worth, from my perspective?
Ma'am, you were next, and I think the last question will be you, ma'am, on the aisle.
Thanks, sir. Lauren Voss, I'm from McKinsey, obviously not here on their behalf, though. I'm just curious, you spoke a little bit about the divisiveness in society today, and I was wondering if you had any specific advice on how to engage with those that have very different views than we have, and to try and change those mindsets, especially now that we say people are, you know, using smaller and smaller circles to get their information and news.
Well, I think we've got to be engaged publicly. The first thing from my perspective, and I would assume this room is full of very reasonable people, is that we can differ in opinions without being enemies. And one of the problems that we have in the world today, in this country in particular, is that we've divided ourselves up. There are those who would have us be divided along certain lines that are difficult to bridge. And varying opinions are often perceived first and foremost as entrenched positions of enmity rather than a point of departure for a constructive conversation where we might find compromise. You know, it can't be, and this is not your, I'm not proposing this, your question conveyed this, but the outcomes of these conversations have got to be compromise. We've got to find a way forward where everyone has the capacity to benefit from the conversations. And it can't be about who's going to be a winner and who's going to be a loser. And, you know, while I am not happy about the rhetoric that seems to have stripped away our capacity as citizens to speak in a civil manner to each other, the one thing I will say about this administration is it administered a huge blow to perhaps my own personal complacency on where I thought we were as a nation. And the differences between us, whether it's racial difference or gender difference or ethnic difference, differences in faith, I think many of us believed that that was in the past. And it clearly is not in the past. It's clearly something that deserves our attention, which is why the number one research priority at Brookings today is the future of the middle class, where we desire to study this at a very detailed level. What are those issues that create the stress on the American middle class? And we define it as the floor of the middle class is at $25,000 of annual income. Can you imagine trying to live on $25,000 for as an annual income? And many Americans today, many Americans in the so-called middle class, if they had an emergent $400 unexpected expense, they'd either have to sell a personal possession or take out a loan. What the hell? So we've got to do two things. We've got to work within our capacity to redress these differences in ways that can create greater unity, greater diversity going forward. Part of that is the civil discourse, but part of that is truly understanding what it's like in regard to the inequality of race in America today. And we have to challenge our assumptions. This goes back to the disruptive influences in here. This is why you all are closer to this than I was. I am grateful in some respects for this moment that we find in American history, because it's forced me to challenge many of the assumptions I'd made about where we had delivered ourselves as a people. And if I'm uncomfortable with that, then that's a good thing, because what this institution is doing, because it has embraced the future of the middle class, the global middle class, by the way, but just and the American middle class, if that's our number one objective, then I think that's a right orientation. The problem we've got in the White House right now, that's just a symptom. It is. It's a symptom. We've got to get after these issues. And so to your question, if we understand, first and foremost, we recognize that we are not enemies if we have differing opinions, and if we all recognize that the outcome of a political conversation should be some form of compromise that benefits both sides, then we have a hope of going forward on almost all the hard issues. And there are going to be some very hard issues. But if we don't come to grips with these, we're going to end up with one administration like this after another. And it might be Democratic, might be Republican, but the nature of what will create our national politics will eventually trend to being simply unacceptable. And we've seen some of that play out in horrible ways in the last 36 hours.
We have time for just one more quick question, and then we'll wrap up.
I'm Erin Neal. I'm with the Atlantic Council's Rafiq Hariri Center for the Middle East. Thank you so much for your remarks tonight. The passion is definitely palpable in the room, and it continues to inspire, you know, young leaders like myself. You mentioned that you have a lot of faith in diversity and young people. So I'm wondering if you can share with us some young people that you might look up to, whether those are individuals or groups, and what those people might have in common, and define young as you wish.
Well, in many respects, I'm surrounded by them tonight, but I'm surrounded by them in the folks at the institution at Brookings. I have a very young chief of staff, I have a very young, you owe me $20 for this, by the way, very young vice president for communications. Well, what inspires me about them is that they live with a set of principles that are admirable. They live with a set of principles that are exemplary and are, by the way, worthy of emulation. And I have said before, some of you in here have spent some time in combat zones, I would guess. I've said before, I grew up in the shadow of the greatest generation, but I believe I led in combat the next greatest generation, and it's your generation. It's people who, young individuals who believe they should be part of something bigger than themselves, for whom principle matters, for whom the rights of those around them and the worth of those around them is important to them. And I think that if we start from that as a going-in proposition, we're going to be okay. I think we're going to be okay. But we've got to solve some of the social issues in the country to create this, once again, unified diversity for us to move forward. But I'm actually pretty optimistic.
Well, you just said that when you were serving as General of the Marines, you led the next greatest generation. And I would argue, sir, you still very much are. Thank you for your comments tonight. It is really a privilege for us to hear from you and appreciate all you've done for this country and for all of us.
Thank you very much. Wonderful to have you here tonight. Thank you.